Studies at Marine Corps University presents the operational and policy implications of Iranian strategic culture and doctrine by Mr. Michael Eisenstadt. This is the fourth lecture in the series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Framing the Iranian Challenge. Mr. Eisenstadt is a senior fellow and director of the Washington Institute's Military and Security Studies Program. A specialist in Persian Gulf and Arab-Israeli security affairs, he has published widely on the armed forces, irregular and conventional warfare, and nuclear weapons proliferation of the Middle East. Prior to joining the Institute in 1989, Mr. Eisenstadt worked as a military analyst with the U.S. government. Mr. Eisenstadt served for 26 years as an officer in the U.S. Army Reserve before retiring with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel in 2010. His military service included active duty tours in Iraq, Jerusalem, the West Bank, Jordan, and Turkey. He has also served in a civilian capacity on the multinational force Iraq, U.S. Embassy, Baghdad Joint Campaign Plan Assessment Team, and as an advisor or consultant to the congressionally mandated Iraq Study Group, the National Academy's Committee on Defeating IEDs, the multinational force Iraq Information Operations Task Force, and the State Department's Future of Iraq Defense Policy Working Group. He also worked on the 1992 U.S. Air Force Gulf War Air Power Survey. Mr. Eisenstadt earned an MA in Arab Studies from Georgetown University and has traveled widely in the Middle East. This lecture took place Tuesday, 11 January 2010, at Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
First of all, thank you for braving the snow and wet coming here. We're very, very happy. If you get stuck, we will pitch a tent or something here. We all stay and have a nice night. But I think it won't get that bad. We are very honored and privileged. And me personally, I'm very happy to see a dear friend, and for you to see somebody that I think is one of the best experts on Iran, Iraq, and Israeli security in Washington. I say that without any hesitation. There's a lot in Washington that wear patches, but there are some who really do the work. And Mr. Mike Eisenstadt is one of those who, when I was teaching in Monterey, I used his work. I just showed him a picture that the two of us were in Israel, and it's more than a decade ago. So we go back, but I have always learned from him personally. I've always, those of you who have worked with me, I have given you his work. They are straight to the point. They are good. Mike Eisenstadt is a specialist in Gulf and Israeli security affairs since 1989 at the Washington Institute. And he's also the Institute's Middle East policy. He also directs the military and security affairs at that institute. In addition to that, those of you who are in the Army, Mike Eisenstadt just retired last year as a Lieutenant Colonel from the Reserves in the Army, and his assignments took in places several tours in Iraq, both as a military, last year was the last, and also as a civilian, he worked in Iraq, but he was also in Jerusalem, the West Bank, Jordan, Turkey, so this is a man who knows the Middle East, has worked there, and as I said, to me, it's his work which keeps on coming out, and each time you hear a fresh idea, and more importantly, you get ideas that will tell you something about the future, what we ought to do on the strategy. And that's why we asked him to come and talk about the operational and policy implications of Iranian strategic culture and doctrine. Without further ado, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Amin, and thank you for inviting me here to talk today. You set a high set of expectations, and I hope I can perhaps just even approach them. So thank you for your very kind words and introduction. What I thought this presentation today I would do is kind of an effort at getting one's arms around the whole issue of Iran as a, let's say, potential adversary. We're often told as soldiers or military analysts never to mirror image a potential adversary or enemy. Rather, we're told that we have to understand foreign countries, foreign militaries, on their own terms, in terms of their own history and culture and military tradition. And this is kind of what I'm giving you today. It's part of a work in progress that I'm kind of engaged in in trying to get my arms around Iran in these terms. And let me just say also, I've been working on Iran issues for about 20 years, but you know, each time I kind of reattack the issue and look at it, I'm constantly learning new things. And this is a country in which I urge you that whenever anybody speaks in terms that smack of certainty when it comes to Iran, you should be instantly suspicious, because this is a country which, and I'll start off with what I call my kind of three rules when looking at Iran. First of all, in Iran, nothing is as it seems. Things are often quite different, sometimes the opposite of what they seem to be. And I'll explain, I'll give you some examples of this in a moment. First of all, nothing in Iran is black and white. Shades of gray prevail, and ambiguity rules with regard to Iran. And in fact, I would almost say this is kind of a culturally ingrained factor of Iranian political culture and politics. And then third, Iran's strategic culture is characterized by numerous contradictions and paradoxes, and I'll give you some examples of that. I also say that Iran, in many ways, is a very unconventional potential adversary that requires unconventional approaches in the realms of war planning, strategy, and policy. And I'm not sure, having lived in D.C. for about 30 years and being attuned and following the policy debate in Iran, I'm not sure we've really always appreciated the ways in which this is so. And again, I'm hoping in my presentation to highlight a number of ways in which Iran is unconventional in ways that we don't often, you know, I mean, a lot of people do recognize many of the unconventional aspects of Iran, but there's even unconventional aspects to the unconventional aspects, which I'll explain in a moment. First thing I'd like to do before moving on to the kind of the substance of my presentation is clear some intellectual underbrush. My first point, I guess, has to do with, you know, whenever you think about Iran from the point of view of the strategic culture, it's almost impossible to kind of get out of your head the whole concept of Iran as the regime actually tries to portray it as a nation of martyrs. I mean, our images in our heads are still wound up with images of suicide or human wave attacks during the Iran-Iraq war, suicide bombings by some of the proxy groups that Iran has at various times supported. And part of this is compounded by the fact that first, Shiite religious doctrine exalts the suffering and martyrdom of the faithful, and religion plays a central role in the official ideology of the Islamic Republic. So there's a tendency, by some people at least, to see Iran as an undeterrable state that's driven by the absolute imperatives of religion, rather than the pragmatic concerns of statecraft. And this impression or image is reinforced also by the fact that Iranian officials deliberately seek to cultivate this image of Iran as a foe whose soldiers seek martyrdom, whose society is willing and able to absorb heavy punishment. I mean, in order to, there's a domestic political reason that they do this, but also to bolster the country's deterrent capability against potential enemies. But I would argue, at least until recently, and things might be changing under President Ahmadinejad, and we can talk about that if I don't get a chance to talk about it during my presentation and maybe during their Q&A, this perception of Iran as this kind of irrational, undeterrable state with a high pain threshold was both, I think, at least until recently, was anachronistic and wrong. Now, I think it was true that in the heady, optimistic early days of the revolution, in the early 80s, early to mid-80s, I think Iranian society did indeed have a relatively high threshold for pain. But as a result of the Iran-Iraq War, the massive bloodletting that entailed, also purges conducted by the regime, there's been a process by which the population has become war-weary, and I would say that in a lot of ways, at least the general population has become a lot more, the society has become a lot more normal society in the way that we think of normal in terms of their attitude towards war and risk-taking. And that by the end of the war, Iran was not, as Ayatollah Khomeini was fond of saying, a nation of martyrs. The country was clearly war-weary, and I would say that at least until recently, that the society has been, since then acting in accordance with, a general sense of principles that were set down by the Ayatollah Khomeini in the latter phases of the war, in which state interest, the expediency of what they call the expediency of the ruling system,
basically trumps religious ideology and decision-making. In other words, raison d'etat, the interest of the regime, is basically the fundamental consideration in decision-making. And I'll expand on that in just a moment. But the bottom line being that within the context of a relatively activist foreign policy, clearly an anti-status quo foreign policy, by and large, Iranian decision-makers have generally sought to minimize risk by avoiding direct confrontation with enemies and by acting through surrogates, such as the Lebanese Hezbollah or special groups in Iraq, in order to preserve deniability and to create ambiguity about their intentions. And I would argue that this behavior is evidence of an ability to engage in rational calculation. And we could talk a little bit, I don't know if I'm going to talk about it in my presentation, but the whole issue of apocalypticism in Iran today, Mahdism, and the impact on decision making that it might have, we could talk about that. But I think there is reason for concern there, though not often in the way that it's presented in the public debate. I also just point out, you know, if we're talking about images, you know, Iran, because the Lebanese Hezbollah did pioneer suicide bombings, you know, we have, you know, Iran and Iran has been kind of closely tied to this tactic because they did support Hezbollah. Hezbollah was founded originally in many ways as an extension of Iranian foreign policy, even though it's evolved into a movement that has its own independent existence and interests. But, you know, Hezbollah more or less gave up suicide bombings in the late 80s. And it's actually, ironically, it's the Sunni Islamist jihadist groups such as Al-Qaeda, which are really now today have taken up the invention and moved it forward. And in fact, we see now that the Iranians are suffering as victims of suicide bombings, you know, Jindala's attacks in Sistan and Baluchistan and the like. So they did play an important role in the invention of this tactic, and now it's kind of boomeranged against them. I would also talk in terms of examples of Iran's rational calculus of decision making. I would give examples such as its behavior during the 1991 Shia uprising and the 1998 Taliban victory in northern Afghanistan, where they acted with great restraint at a time when Shiite communities were imperiled. Despite the temptation, in fact, despite the calls for intervention in Afghanistan in 1998, they did not intervene. But again, I think the shadow of the Iran-Iraq war loomed large. Did not want to get involved in a quagmire and another protracted war. We see examples of this kind of questioned decision making during the war between Israel and Hezbollah in the summer of 2006, when they acted with great caution in that regard. During the war in Gaza in 2008-2009, where their first was actually a call for volunteers to go over to fight, and then it was kind of quashed by the supreme leader. And then finally, if you remember, after the Mavi Marmara affair, there were at least some people who wanted to have an Iranian flotilla to Gaza, and for reasons that are not clear, that was squashed. But I, by and large, I think we see a pattern of cautious decision making as a result of this principle of maslaha, that state interest takes precedence over a religious ideology. The next point has to do with Iran as a secular theocracy, and which might sound somewhat, a paradoxical term. And it gets to this concept that I talked about, that despite the fact that it is a theocracy, religious or state decision making is guided by the interests of the regime, which trump religious ideology. And again, it goes back to, as I mentioned before, this statement made, or these letters that were written by Ayatollah Khomeini in 87 and 88 before he died, which basically authorized the Iranian state to destroy a mosque or suspend the observance of the pillars of Islam if state interest required it. And this gets to the issue of another thing which you see sometimes raised in public debates about Iran's nuclear program, with the whole issue of the nuclear fatwa that Ayatollah Khomeini apparently issued in 2003, which basically said it was against the principles of Islam to develop, stockpile, or use nuclear weapons. And this is often a talking point used by representatives of the Iranian government to say we can't have nuclear ambitions in terms of having a military nuclear program because it's against our religion. And I would just say, again, this requires drilling down to, second or third levels in order to understand exactly what's going on here. The fact of the matter is, and again, I lean on the work of one of my colleagues at the Washington Institute, Medicalaji, who I don't have a background in Islamic thought or jurisprudence, although many does. He studied 14 years to be a cleric before he picked a different career path. And one, you know, one of the things that, you know, in our conversations he's mentioned is that, look, you know, fatwas are issued under certain circumstances and can be reversed or changed when circumstances change. And he's given, there's some examples we could discuss during the Q&A, but the bottom line being, the original fatwa was issued in 2003 after the discovery of Natanz at a time when Iran was under great pressure because of the discovery of their clandestine nuclear program. And it was probably done, this is my surmise, to deflect attention, or to deflect, you know, the deflect the international pressure that, you know, followed from the discovery of the enrichment plant at Natanz. And therefore, you know, if conditions can change, there's nothing to stop it from issuing another fatwa, which would permit the development of nuclear weapons. Again, in accordance with the principle that the state interests trump religious ideology. And that really is the most more fundamental point, because again, it doesn't matter, you know, in the end that anything can be justified on the basis of state interest. And it's really, when you get back to the base of this argument, it's really this, that if you believe, as you know, the people in the regime in Tehran do, that Iran's brand or the Islamic Republic's brand of revolutionary Islam will only survive if the Islamic Republic can survive, then the survival of the regime is the paramount consideration and concern. And therefore, it trumps everything else. And that's really kind of the basis of that concept. Third point, and we're getting now to issues of military force structure and the like. Large ambitions don't necessarily translate to large military forces. One thing that's really interesting when looking at Iran is the gross disparity between the self-image of the regime, where they see themselves as not just a regional power, but, and you hear this more recently in recent years under President Ahmadinejad, but as a rising world power that wants to play a role in and they use the term, the management of world affairs. They want to see themselves playing a key role in the management of the international system in the world. And they see the U.S. as a declining power. And what's interesting, you know, this very expansive self-image goes back a long way, and it goes back to the beginning of the Islamic Republic. Although I think other Ahmadinejad has gotten a new level. And you would have thought this would translate to an impulse to build a very large conventional military in order to have a military force that is commensurate of that of a great power. Now, clearly, Iran has labored under all kinds of pressures. You know, efforts by the United States and other countries to deny them the ability to purchase arms. They've had financial problems and the like, but my sense is that they had the money, if they wanted to build a much larger military than they wanted to. And the fact that they had it, I think, is because of their understanding of the nature of hard versus soft power, and this is something I'll discuss a little more in a minute. We tend to, when looking at military capabilities, focus on hard power attributes. When we look at Iran, we look at their naval capabilities in the Gulf, we look at their ground power, we look at their air force, and we also look at post forces and unconventional capabilities, but we put a heavy emphasis on conventional military power. And in a way, that's because we put a premium on conventional military power in our power projection, as well as our ability to influence events around the world. Iran, I think, has a different balance in the relative importance of hard versus soft power. And I think one reason why they haven't built such a large conventional military is because they put such heavy emphasis on soft power. That being said, they have done a very good job at building up niche capability and focused investment developing naval capabilities that could interfere with ship freedom of navigation in the Gulf, and they're taking advantage of their geographic proximity to, you know, the shipping lines of communication through the Strait of Hormuz. And they've also done a very good job at identifying potential adversary vulnerabilities and building capabilities that could exploit these vulnerabilities. In terms of our heavy reliance on large surface ships, carrier battle groups and the like, and putting a heavy emphasis on anti-ship missiles, mine warfare capabilities, and the like, as well as swarming, small naval units to conduct swarming operations. So I think they've done a very good job at getting the maximum bang for the buck, given that they really haven't, you know, put a tremendous degree of emphasis on conventional forces. Also, as I mentioned before, they really have put a tremendous emphasis on unconventional warfare. Now, first of all, part of this is, I think, rooted in the culture, the political culture of the country. If you look at how they wage domestic politics, there's been a heavy reliance, even going back to the time of the Shah, of armed vigilante groups playing a role, of street strong arms and thugs playing a role. And under the Islamic Republic, this role was played by groups like Ansar-e Hizbollah. So they do, even when dealing with each other domestically in terms of politics, there's a tendency to rely on proxies and use indirection and the like. The best example is how the regime dealt with President Khatami after his election in 97. It took them 2 years of, closing down newspapers, street action by thugs and vigilantes, selective assassination or attempted assassination of key people in order to roll back the reform movement then. So this is how they engage in domestic politics, and so it's no surprise that this is looms large in their foreign policy as well. The activities of the Coast Force with regard to Hezbollah, special groups in Iraq. I'm less familiar with what they're doing in Afghanistan in this area. But and then also their support for Hamas and the CPS. But this is another way in which they've been able to really leverage their influence and have a tremendous degree of influence on developments throughout the Middle East and even beyond, with a actually relatively negligible investment of manpower and resources. We also see this tendency to rely on conventional warfare in the naval arena. I just mentioned a moment ago the small boats. Their navy has often been referred to as kind of a naval guerrilla warfare force, and I think that's a correct characterization of it. So there is a more heavy emphasis on unconventional warfare in their international security concept and doctrine. But I would also argue that they put a heavy emphasis on psychological warfare. We tend to look at, we now call it, MISO, Military Information Support for Operations. And the implication that comes from that is that military information supports kinetic operations. That the decisive line of operation is kinetic operations, our information operations and other information activities support information operations. I would argue that Iran, in many cases, considers the information line of operation as their decisive line of operation. And they often engage in military activities in order to support their information line of operation. And this is not just true of Iran. We see this with Al-Qaeda, the emphasis put on media operations. And that very often media, that the whole purpose of an operation is to create an image for the media outfit. And Hezbollah was also, this was a technique followed by Hezbollah. So we also see this in terms of the state level, that Iran also conducts itself in such a way. Now, it's the way that they conduct themselves vis-a-vis their adversaries, vis-a-vis the United States. And it's also the way that they believe the United States conducts itself with regard to Iran. Because we see tremendous emphasis in the Iranian literature, as well as statements by senior officials on American soft war efforts, American psychological warfare, and attempts to foment the Velvet Revolution. So the importance that they assign to the psychological dimension of warfare, I think, is something which we don't, again, fully appreciate. It's something which I think we've lost in our own military tradition. But if you look at Clausewitz, he does give significant emphasis to the psychological dimension in warfare. I don't see it, though, receiving sufficient emphasis in the way that we think about warfare, although for a time during the surge, it was recognized that changing the psychological environment in Iraq was an important part of what we were trying to accomplish. But I'm not sure this has been ingrained in our doctrine to a degree which is sufficiently desirable. So Iran puts tremendous emphasis on the psychological dimension in their statecraft and in foreign policy. And this is why they also are always trying to spin things when they're advertise new weapon systems that they're testing, which in many cases are really nowhere near as capable or ready for deployment as they advertise. But this is part of their whole effort to create, again, if images or if perceptions are reality, then, you know, creating a certain perception of themselves in the region and vis-a-vis adversaries is critically important for them, and they put a real heavy emphasis on this. And I think in their context, that's one reason why I think nuclear weapons are so important for them. First of all, it's, you know, if you want to build a large conventional military, you would have to have spent hundreds of billions of dollars. A squadron, just one squadron of modern fighter aircraft, is several billion dollars. Just that's on the front end, never mind life cycle costs. So to build a large conventional military, you would have to spend hundreds of billions. To make yourself a nuclear power, you might only have to spend, you know, a few billion or 10 billion. You know, it's much smaller amounts of money, so you can do it with, you know, fewer resources expended. And nuclear weapons are the ultimate psychological warfare weapons. Look what how it's already Iran's, you know, perceived intentions to create a capability, or their actions to create a capability or a nuclear option are already driving many of their neighbors crazy, and many countries outside the region. So I think that's also why they put such heavy emphasis on nuclear weapons. It's, again, it's the ultimate psychological warfare weapon. Just one little point though about force structure and the like, another paradox about Iran. You know, those of us who are familiar with the Iraqi military under Saddam, and the Syrian military under the Assads, you know, are used to a certain type of model of authoritarianism, that the best units in the regime, such as the Iraqi Republican Guard in Syria, it was Unit 569, the defense companies, and then eventually the Republican Guard, always got the best weapons. But what's interesting, in Iran, the Revolutionary Guard doesn't get the best weapons. They basically, their air wing has Tucano fighters and Brazilian Tucano prop trainers. Basically, most of their navy is the small boats, a few of the fast attack craft armed with missiles. But the larger elements are in the regular navy. The larger, the most modern fighter aircraft are in the regular air force. And again, I think that has to do with the culture of the Red Guard, that they believe that the psychological dimension and the spiritual dimension of warfare is the dominant one, and therefore having the best weapons is not necessarily the key to their success on the battlefield. And that gets again to the point I was making about the importance of the psychological dimension of warfare. With regard to deterrence and warfighting, you know, in terms of talking about our own deterrent and warfighting triad, we tend to talk about, traditionally, in terms of our nuclear triad, we talk about land-based ballistic missiles, land-based bombers, and submarine-based ballistic missiles. Iran has a deterrent triad as well, but it's a very different one. First of all, it's their naval forces and their ability to interfere with the shipping of oil through the Strait of Hormuz is part of their deterrent capability. And one reason why they conduct so many exercises in the Gulf, which involve scenarios involving closing the strait, which I think they don't have the ability to do, but they want to create this perception that they can do it, is again to strengthen their deterrent posture and image. The second leg of their deterrent triad is their ability, both through their own assets as well as assets belonging to other groups such as Hezbollah, special groups in Iraq, and proxies in other parts of the world. The third part of the deterrent triad is, you know, what we're used to thinking about, you know, their missile forces, either armed with conventional warheads or unconventional warheads. But there's also a twist here, because Iran has put tremendous emphasis on building a very large rocket force, conventional rocket force. And it's possible they also have unconventional warheads, maybe chemical warheads for some of the rockets. But they put tremendous emphasis on rocket forces. In fact, they have some of their longest range rockets in the Zelzal family have ranges approaching those of the Scud B, you know, 250-300 kilometer range. And the reason being is evident if you look at the map, a lot of the rationale for this. First of all, they used a lot of these rockets during the Iran-Iraq war. And the reason is a lot of their neighbors lack strategic depth. A lot of major Iraqi cities are very close to the border of Iran, whereas a lot of Iranian major cities are in the kind of central plateau of Iran, far from their neighbors and enjoy the benefits of strategic depth. But their enemy, their potential enemies in Iraq and the Gulf, all the Gulf Emirates, all their major towns are on the Gulf, are kind of as close to Iran as land permits them to be. So by building a large number of rockets, first of all, you increase the mass of your you know, long-range strike forces. You don't have just heavy, expensive missiles. You have a large number of rockets. And if these are terror weapons, from the point of view of the average civilian in these countries, it doesn't matter whether it's a Scud coming at you or a Shahab or one of these short-range rockets. You're terrified, and the whole point is, again, psychological intimidation. The problem from our point of view is that whenever you hear discussions about Iran's ballistic capabilities or missile capabilities, and we talk about missile defenses, we don't really pay much attention to the rocket forces. And this gets into an area where I'm not an expert, and I don't know whether my sense is that our missile defenses are not capable of dealing with a lot of these rockets because of the radar cross section. These are smaller; they're much smaller than the Shahabs. And plus, they could launch them in much larger numbers and overwhelm our missile defenses. And from the point of view, again, of a civilian on the receiving end, it doesn't matter. They're terrified for their lives. So they accomplish a lot of what they're by developing these rockets, and we tend to ignore these kind of systems and capabilities. But look what these rocket systems did in Lebanon in 2006 against the Israelis. And we all know those in Iraq know that a lot of the special groups have make use of those smaller caliber rockets, against the international zone and American FOBs. And then they serve a purpose as harassing American forces there. So rockets, as much as missiles, are part of their deterrent triad. The next point I just want to talk about is a little bit about their resistance doctrine and the whole concept you hear of resistance. And let me just also say, if anybody has any insights on any of these issues, I'd welcome your comments and thoughts in terms of the genesis of this whole resistance doctrine. But I think this is one area where I think the doctrine actually may have been developed by Hezbollah, adopted by the Syrians and Hamas and Iran. So I'm not sure this is something which was developed initially by the Iranians, but it's something that they do talk about a lot. And the whole essence of their resistance doctrine, I think, at least my understanding of it, is that it rests on the whole idea of achieving victory over one's enemy by demoralizing one's enemy, not by seizing enemy terrain or winning military victories as traditionally understood, but by terrorizing enemy civilians, leading enemy armies, and denying the enemy battlefield victories. I think that conforms to what they were trying to accomplish in Iraq. And I think that's how they look at themselves in terms of the long-term competition with the U.S. Likewise. Also, another component of this is that there are elements within the regime in Tehran for whom tension and conflict with external enemies are seen as a vital force that energizes and revitalizes the political system, or at least the political base of certain elements within the system. As I said, the majority of Iranians are, I think, want to avoid another Iran-Iraq war and are not motivated by the ideology of the regime, are disaffected from the ideology of the regime. But there is a certain part of the population, and nobody knows what percentage, when you hear figures, 15%, 20% of the population who are still wedded to the ideology, the original ideology of the revolution, who are true believers in the ideology of the revolution. And for them, and for people who represent them, such as the president, the current president of Iran, conflict and tension with the outside world actually, I think, energizes their base and their system. And therefore, this creates all kinds of problems for us in terms of deterrence, which I will discuss in my conclusions. But how do you deal with an enemy that might welcome limited conflict? And when you start thinking through it, it really poses it's kind of the sadist masochist, dynamic. It's kind of how do you actually, from a point of view of statecraft, get out of this? And there's an answer to it, but it's not politically acceptable in the United States at this point. But there's always the escalation dominance answer. But after Iraq and Iran, that's not a viable option. So we could talk about that. Also, the whole resistance doctrine, by its nature, is a form of protracted conflict, which requires its practitioners to play the long game. And this gets into the whole issue of the issue of time with regard to Iran. Iran, at least the decision-making elites, I think, have a very different conception of time scale than do our politicians. We have a four-year election cycle. but it's really 2.5 years in which, you know, you can do things and when you're unhindered by domestic politics, at which time, you know, when that starts changing. In Iran, in many areas pursues a policy of strategic patience. And I think it's rooted in culture to a certain extent, because I think you could look in, Iranians could look at Shia and Persian history and their own cultural heritage for examples of the benefits of strategic patience. If you look at the life biography of Imam Ali, who was the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, he, you know, the whole break between Sunnis and Shiites was, you know, was he supposed to be the second caliph, or the first caliph, the first follower of Muhammad or not? Now, he was originally passed over for the successorship, but he eventually became the caliph. He was the fourth caliph. So in his life, he showed that by patience, by waiting, and waiting out his enemies, he was able eventually to prevail and succeed. And to be a little glib, even in Iranian literature at the literary classic 101 Nights, Scheherazade saves her own life through a strategy of delay. So this is a culture, I would say, that is doesn't have a problem with strategic patience or strategies that require a great deal of patience. I would also argue that if you look at the way that the regime dealt with the reform movements in 97 and then last year, there were no Tiananmen Square moments where the army or the Red Guard was pulled out to the streets and they crushed the opposition in a single action. It was a policy, again, of patience, of indirection, of using, you know, kind of demoralizing and ultimately humiliating the enemy. And I mentioned what happened with Khatami before, but, you know, after last year, you had, again, part of the reason I don't think they sent the Red Guard and the besieged into the streets in a way that, you know, to create to crush the opposition is because they had concerns about the reliability of the security forces. So there were pragmatic considerations there. But I think they also, again, I think it's perhaps rooted in the strategic culture and political culture of the country, that they're able and willing to wait out their enemy and to deal with them, again, by indirection. They eventually arrested a lot of the organizers of the Green Movement, held trials where they were humiliated, and just had the effect of demoralizing those who were not arrested yet. So I think there's, again, I don't have my arms completely around this phenomenon, but I think there's a there in terms of, there's a cultural dimension to this, you know, observation about strategic, patience. And this is problematic because if you look at our own strategic culture, what do we talk about? We talk about surges, we talk about decisive operations, and quick exit strategies. And again, we have the 4-year election cycle, which we do have in Iran, but it's very often the same bunch of people who've been around for 30 years who keep getting recycled. So they can afford to be a little more patient as well because of the way the system has worked. So it's very hard for Americans who are going to be, we know we're a culture that, you know, we have fast food, we're very patient, but it's reflected in our military culture too. Iran has a much different approach to the time dimension. My final comments have to do with, again, something which, again, I've raised before, the whole issue of psychological warfare, soft warfare, and soft power. But again, I can't emphasize enough the importance to which I think soft power and psychological warfare, you know, plays, you know, in the way the Iranians look at, you know, how they deal with adversaries. And let me give you a few examples from Iraq. You know, there's been in a lot of the debate about Iraq in, you know, the coming year as we are finally drawing our military forces down and perhaps leaving finally Iraq. And I say maybe because we don't know whether the Iraqis vote right now. Prime Minister Maliki says, you know, no need for the U.S. to stay. That might change in the course of this year. We don't know. But the bottom line is we talked about, you know, why it's important for the, you know, why does the U.S., if it retains a residual capability in Iraq, why does it need to do so? Well, because the Iraqis don't have the ability to defend their airspace or territorial waters. They don't have the ability to secure their borders. And again, we tend to focus on the conventional capabilities, but what we're missing is that all the things that the Iranians are doing in the area with regard to their efforts to extend their soft power in Iraq, that we need to be countering. And actually, I'm just finishing up a study with some colleagues on the whole issue of Iranian influence in Iraq. And soft power really looms large in the study. And this is an area where I think we've been partially successful in dealing with it, especially with regard to our information operations in Iraq, against the Iranians. Because this is one area when you talk to military officers in Iraq and you ask them what's our most effective, you know, means of countering Iranian influence in Iraq, that they will tell you it's IO, information operations. But I don't think we're doing as much as we can be doing. And the way that the Iranians have used their soft power is I'll go down to this several fold. First of all, for economic reasons mainly, they've done all they could to implement protectionist measures and trade policies that disadvantage Iraq, and therefore the trade balance between the two countries, I think the latest estimate is that the amount of two-way trade between the two countries is $7 billion or so. And the estimates are that about 90% of it is going from Iran to Iraq. And this has had a very harmful effect on the agricultural sector in Iraq as well as light industrial sector. But by creating this asymmetry, it also contributes to the weakness of the Iraqi economy and ensuring that Iraq remains a weak neighbor, which then, you know, makes it easier for Iran to, I won't say impose their will on them, but to project their influence vis-a-vis the Iraqi government. They've also filled the gap. You know, one of the main things that have happened since 2003 is the dramatic rise in the demand for electricity in Iraq because of the dramatic increase in the availability of consumer goods, air conditioning and the like, and TVs. And they stepped into the gap, and they now provide about 8% of Iraq's total electricity needs countrywide. But in the bordering provinces, the percentage is much higher. I don't know the number, but it's much higher for those provinces. And they've often used electricity for political things, that they've turned off the electricity, or at least there's a perception in Iraq that when there have been protests by parties such as Cyrus last summer, they had the electricity protests in Basra, by Cyrus against the poor delivery of services by the central government. At the same time, the Iranians cut back their electricity delivery to Basra to send to further compound the problems and support the Cyrists during the protests. So, now, interestingly, also I found a quote by an Iranian Red Guard official, and I'll be wrapping up in about 2 or 3 minutes. You know, we'll go to Q&A. I saw a comment by a Red Guard official who is responsible for what they call. You know, I forgot the directorate, but they have, it's kind of infrastructure protection directorate in Iran to, you know, protect the country against potential attacks by the United States or Israel. And he said, well, what we need to do, what Iran needs to do is create dependencies with our neighbors in the areas of oil pipelines and electricity and the like, so that if we are attacked, it will have ripple effects. And look at almost all of Iran's neighbors are American allies. So being, you know, the message being that if you attack Iran, you will also be hurting your allies, and you will hear it from your allies as well. This is part of their soft power. They've also tried to export their brand of revolutionary Islam in Iran, in Iraq. And part of the reason is to ensure, first of all, to limit the influence of the school of Najaf, which is basically a competing school that has a different perspective on the role of clerics in politics, a more quietistic role, not completely not involved in politics, but not the model of a clerical rule that you have in Iran. So they've been trying to do things in Iran to limit the ideological or to weaken the you know, clerics in Iraq, so that they cannot pose a challenge to the ideological model of Iranian Islam. But also, they've been putting a lot of money, just like the Saudis did in the 90s, to to invest in the madrasas and cultural centers. The Iranians have been doing this around the world in order to create links among the Shiite communities around the world, so that if Iran is attacked, the Shiite communities around the world will rally to their defense. And then finally, they've been doing trying to win Iraqi hearts and minds through Arabic language broadcasts in Iraq, although polling data shows that they've not been very successful in this area. But the bottom line is they put a lot of emphasis on soft power, and this is an area which I think we're not doing enough to counter. The bottom line is, again, like I said, you know, I think the military has learned as a result of our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan the importance of information operations. I'm not sure our senior political leadership in Washington understands this. And as a result, I don't believe we've done all we can do in the area of information activities vis-a-vis Iran. And if those of you who are interested in reading more about this, I wrote a monograph about a year ago, which is on the website of the Washington Institute, called Missing Lever, Information Activities Against Iran, which basically says, you know, we're focusing on diplomacy and economic pressure, but information activities is what the Iranians actually fear the most from us. They're not really worried about an invasion because they know we're not going to invade. But they really are worried about what they call soft war and the cultural, the appeal of Western and American culture. And this is an area we need to do more. So to wrap up my my presentation, basically, I guess to sum up, what I would say is, again, to reinforce the comments that I started off with, Iran is an unconventional adversary that requires unconventional approaches. I'm not sure we're doing everything we can do, I need to do in order to deal with our Iranian influence. We focus still too much on their hard power and not enough on their soft power. And when we do focus on their hard power, we often don't focus on the right hard power capabilities, or we overlook certain capabilities such as the rockets. We focus on the missiles, which are important, and we need to focus on that. But we also need to focus on the rockets. Not enough emphasis on the informational instrument of national power in dealing with the Iranians. We've not really also come to grips with the implications of Iran's self-image and their image of us as a power in decline, and how that could create the potential for miscalculation with regard to Iran, which could cause them to overplay their hand, just as Saddam Hussein in the past overplayed his hand vis-a-vis the United States. The whole issue of ambiguity, if in the future we try to build an extended deterrence regime against Iran that is pursuing a policy of ambiguity with regard to its nuclear capabilities, it might be very hard to convince some of our allies to take steps that are necessary to deter Iran if Iran is, again, pursues a policy of ambiguity. It's much easier to deal with an adversary that's like the Soviet Union in the Cold War that advertises nuclear capabilities than with an enemy or an adversary that doesn't even admit it has nuclear weapons or nuclear ambitions. And then finally, we've not figured out how to deal with a political system that thrives on isolation and conflict with the outside world, at least elements of which in the system thrive on isolation and conflict with the outside world. And how do you deter an adversary that has perhaps leaders who might welcome conflict under certain circumstances? I'll leave it at that, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Before we open the floor to Q&A, one other thing, if you need to, most of our, with the exception of one or two of the lectures in the Iran series, most of them are online. Our website is the Marine Corps University website. On the left side there's Middle East Studies, or myself, Adam Seitz, who manages most of these, is here. You can put your name and we'll give it to you. We do have DVDs as well, so you can have access and listen to these or use it in your own PAB or whatever use you have. And just an announcement, our next speaker will be on, the date is 28 February, Ambassador John Limber. He was a U.S. diplomat in Iran and one of the hostages, and his last post was an advisor and assistant secretary of state for Iranian affairs. It will be in the same room here. Again, if you want to be in the distribution list, please see Adam or myself, and we'll put you on that one. Please ask your questions and just briefly introduce yourself, please.
General Mike Lewis, I'm the Special Operations Chair for the University. Based on your discussion of the regions of the regime, trumping religion, the strategic concept of deterrence, the belief in information operations, self-image, and then the cultures of the nations, you can make an assumption that the development of a nuclear weapon capability is inevitable for Iran. And then our fear, of course, is based on the assumption that if any nation state is going to actually employ nuclear weapons, it would be Iran. Are those assumptions correct, true? What do you think?
I mean, my feeling is that there are a very strong set of motivators which are pushing them in the direction of having a capability, and I think eventually, in the long run, I think there's no substitute to having a force in being than having virtual capability, or people talk about the Japanese model and the like. I think for a number of reasons, beyond Stuxnet and assassination of nuclear scientists and the like, it's quite likely that they will continue on the current path of not actually going down the route of actually producing a weapon, but actually kind of creating the infrastructure and the raw materials needed for that for quite some time. Because first of all, and there's a number of reasons for that. I think the most important being that they're getting, from their point of view, a lot of the benefits of nuclear weapons possession without actually getting it. Because again, they're scaring the daylights of a lot of their neighbors. And a lot of the neighbors are already kind of adjusting, realigning their policies to take into consideration the possibility that Iran will eventually become a nuclear power, and therefore, acting accordingly. That doesn't mean necessarily that they, kind of accommodate Iran, because I think, as we see often in this part of the world, people often do several things at once. While accommodating on one level, they deepen their relationship with the U.S. and they build up their military capabilities. So it's not a binary either-or option. So I think in the long run, Iran, we'll probably look at the Iraq example of 1990, where Iraq had, at Oserac, highly enriched uranium, which was weapons grade. And that after they invaded Kuwait and they realized the United States was going to mobilize to throw them out of Kuwait, they implemented a crash program to turn that enriched uranium into a weapon, but they weren't able to do it in time. And I think that in the long run, Iran might not want to be in that situation where they don't have a force in being. They have all this enriched uranium sitting around and it's not weaponized, and then something happens and then, oh crap, and this, the war's over. And so in the long run, I think they head in that direction. But for now, I think, look, again, they're very patient. This is a program that's been going on since 85. They made very slow progress. It's not a crash program. So I think they're happy to continue with the way they are going right now. Plus, from their point of view, any kind of rush to weaponize risks an attack by the U.S. and Israel, or Israel, and they'd rather have a large stockpile of low-enriched uranium on hand so that if part of it gets bombed, enough of it, even if 50% gets destroyed, the 50% that survives is maybe enough for 10 or 20 weapons. So I think they could push this, down the road. The joker here is North Korea. We had Siegfried Hecker, who was head of one of our national labs, just came back from North Korea a few weeks ago saying the North Koreans revealed to him a centrifuge enrichment plant we didn't know about before. And that it's modern, it's operating, and that is, according to the North Koreans, it's producing low enriched uranium for an energy program. But conceivably, this is a program which is outside the reach of Israeli savage wars, was it in North Korea. Maybe there's a way to get viruses into there, but I suspect it's much more of a hard problem than the Iranian nuclear facilities, and it's under a nuclear umbrella now. So there's always a possibility that, for money, the North Koreans might provide fissile material from there, and that might upset some of our timelines in this regard. So that, that's it. In terms of use, we're really getting into Terry and Kanye here in terms of Iran. Look, by and large, the logic of my argument is, you could reasonably say, well, then we don't really have to worry about Iran using a bomb. But since, state interest trumps ideology, and since they ultimately want to preserve the regime, they're not going to do anything that will potentially endanger the regime. The problem is this. I think my main concern is miscalculation. Well, there's several fold. First, miscalculation. Some of Ahmadinejad's, I don't believe he is a nihilistic apocalyptic. There are these sets. We had in Iraq with the Army of Heaven, that really crazy group that was going to go to Najaf and kill all the Marjas, kill Sistani and others, to bring on the reappearance of the Mahdi. And we also happened, they had groups like that in Iran. Under Khatami, there were actually one group in particular, Madaviyat. It was only a small group of 30 people. They bombed the chief of the judiciary in Tehran in 1999, and they had plans to kill, I think, Khatami and Rafsanjani. So whenever you have this stuff in the air, craziness does hit. There's always a potential for craziness to happen. Ahmadinejad, as far as we understand, is not from that. He is the outer fringes of kind of the mainstream apocalyptic trend, which is, you know, basically, you know, fight for justice and to create and through the actions of the Islamic Republic, you rebalance the international balance of power so that you know countries such as the United States that are bullying that are representing justice are checked and constrained. My concern though is that if you believe and some of his opponents, presidential candidate also he said this on his website, on his Facebook page. You know, the worry is that if you believe that the Mahdi is going to reappear in 2 or 3 years, then maybe you act in ways that are irresponsible because you don't believe that you'll have to live with the consequences of your actions. And you'll do things irresponsible from the point of view of public policy, from the point of view of the economy, and maybe from the point of view of dealing with the U.S. and Israel. So that's my concern, is that it might result in dangerous risk-taking, not to bring on an apocalypse, results in a nuclear war in the coming of the Mahdi, but that results in miscalculation vis-a-vis the U.S. And if you believe that Iran's a rising power and the U.S. is constrained in Afghanistan and Iraq and is a declining power, maybe you do foolish things. And that's in a way that's what happened to Saddam Hussein in 1990. He was, I don't want to take this parallel too far because there's a lot of differences between the two regimes. But Saddam said, we're a rising, Iraq's a rising power, the Persian Gulf is the center of the world economy. Whoever controls the oil in the Gulf controls the world economy. And the United States, will eventually, kind of live with whatever, we do here. So my concern is in a somewhat similar situation that the regime will over place hand. My other concern is that you have a problem with instability in the country. If there is a revolution happening in the future and the regime has nuclear weapons, might they, and they believe that the United States is behind the revolution. This is a Velvet Revolution that we're implementing. Might they, in their potty shots, give nuclear weapons to terrorists, or might they try through their own networks to use nuclear weapons, either in the region against American facilities or against the American homeland? I worry about that. And there's a couple of other things I worry about, but those are, I think, the main concerns, as I look at a nuclear Iran. And you're also talking about a regime that their worldview is just so different than ours. Read Mazyar Bahari's account of his interrogation. He's a Newsweek correspondent who was kept in about 3 months in Iran by the Red Guard intelligence people. And read about their worldview that of these guys as seen by him. He says you have to understand the worldview of the Red Guard that who are now playing an increasingly important role. And they will, in the nuclear program, they will be the ones who have their, they will have, it will be a Red Guard finger on the trigger, getting orders from Tehran. And they live in an alternative universe in terms of reality, in terms of these conspiracies and the like. And likewise, the president, Ahmadinejad, and this is my final point, I'm sorry about that, but, in his speech to the General Assembly last September, where he talked about, 9-11. Now, he says, maybe there were people in the U.S. government who were responsible for 9-11. Osama bin Laden on video acknowledged responsibility for 9-11. So anybody should be able to find that, anybody who has a YouTube account, But, he still believes that maybe it was the U.S. government who did it. So I don't believe everything politicians say, but I think, their worldview is an alternative parallel universe that we don't quite understand. And then you toss in the whole, the modest dimension. I don't want to say, again, thus far, they've been pretty good at understanding, the limits of their power and the like, but there is a potential for miscalculation, I worry about.
Yes, please, all the way there.
Hi, my name is James from the CIA. My question is, when we look at the student uprising that we had several months back, and there were immediate Facebook and Twitter from students that were involved publishing to the world what was actually happening, what impact do you think that technology and the younger generation is going to have on Iranian politics?
I'll be honest with you, this is really outside of my lane. I don't have, first of all, I know there were some controversies at the time whether the Facebook revolution, really Facebook played the role that was attributed to it during the events of June of last year. I don't have the ability, this whole issue of the impact of IT technology on politics is really a very specialized area that you really need to have a good grasp of, and I don't have that. So I really, you know, I have to apologize, I wish I could answer the question, except to say, you know, just keep in mind there were critiques of the initial kind of version of events that it was a Facebook revolution, that, you know, there were some critiques that said, actually, you know, now that we've done some looking at some of the message traffic and Facebook traffic, that it really wasn't as important. I don't have the qualifications to say whether that's true or not, so I can't weigh in on that debate, except to say that the Revolutionary Guard did set up a whole corps of cyber warriors, that they were sufficiently exercised by, you know, and concerned about the possibility that, information technology could play a subversive role, but they are very big in this area, and my understanding is that they also are very sophisticated. Hearing from Iranians who have seen things happen that, from their point of view, indicate that the regime is watching, you know, email traffic going in and out of the country and the like, and that they're very good at this. But it indicates to me, this gets back to the whole issue of the soft warfare, the emphasis they put on it. Iran is a very large country that has, from traditional military terms, tremendous strategic depth. Iran is in the middle of the country. It would be very hard. It's got mountains surrounding it. They're pretty well protected from invasion. But they have no strategic depth when it comes to the exposure of every citizen to potentially subversive messages from abroad, either by internet, by satellite television. They have no strategic depth on the level of IT. And that's why they're scared, because we have the potential to reach every family in the country, you know, one way or another, or except for the most, you know, poorly developed villages. And that's a tremendous vulnerability, because they realize they have a problem in terms of the legitimacy of the regime and the appeal of the regime's ideology in the younger generation, and even among the older people. And this speaks directly to that. So this is an area we need to be doing a lot more, because they're telling us what scares them. Because their constant emphasis on soft war, we should listen more, is all I can say.
Before I take another question, I met somebody when I was in Tampa a couple of months ago. Immediately after this, I would like to introduce you with him. He is working on a book as we speak on the very question we have. I will just tell you his name when you meet me. Any next question? Yes, please.
Douglas Strusen with the Command Staff Faculty. Mike, I congratulate you on a very nuanced and careful and comprehensive presentation. And there are just a couple of niches I'd like to push on. One thing, the issue of strategic depth, if you look back into the longer history of the country, back into the 16th century, for example, the Iran, as we know it, exists because of its use of strategic depth. So that's a deep element of national strategic culture. I think that one issue that might make is that another reason for their lack of emphasis on conventional military technology is the regime's, I think, lingering distrust of a professional military, which goes back to the Red Baron and fits into the parallels between the Islamic Republic and the Soviet Union. So that's one point there. One element I'd like to ask you about. You mentioned you have opposed the sort of modest or apocalyptic view toward the national interest. There's also the issue of the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic, has a 12 or Shi'i regime with an agenda of not necessarily ending the world, but of restoring true Islam to its proper position. And it occurs to me that they might see achieving the destruction of Israel, which the Sunni Arabs have failed to do, as a means of gaining paramountcy for Shia Islam. And that's not something I've seen in the literature. I've been thinking about it, and I will hear from you.
Actually, thank you for your comments. First of all, I appreciate your kind words, and actually, you know, your comments have nothing to contest with them, and I wouldn't dare to. Is you do know your stuff really well, Duncan. So I would just say the one thing with the strategic depth, there was an exception after 2003. There was for about three or four years, a period in which they were very fearful that the United States would, you know, follow up, you know. Our war in Iraq with the war, an attempt to invade Iran, and they did actually reorganize the siege at the time. You know, this whole idea of this Mosaic doctrine was kind of being motivated by that. Although I think now they're no longer, you know, have this concern anymore. But there was, you know, there was this period. And I appreciate you mentioning that, but you did kind of remind me that I should have mentioned that there was this one period of kind of exception. With regard to the destruction of Israel, I think this is, Most Iranians, I don't think, really are not, you know, kind of seized on this notion and don't really care much because they care more about their daily concerns. But the people, the leadership of the regime, I agree with you, for them this is a key point. And if you look at Karim Sajidpour's really excellent short monograph on the thinking of Khamenei, he talks about how Khamenei is kind of fixated on this, that he sees creation of Israel as a manifestation of injustice, and this gets into the whole Shiite narrative of justice and injustice, and this is a very strong theme in Shiite Islam. And so I think it is very important for many of the senior people in the regime. This is an important project for them, and they do have a goal seeing the destruction of Israel. Ahmadinejad speaks about it all the time. Khamenei talks about it, that, you know, that in our lifetimes we will see, you know, the destruction of Israel. My feeling is that though we should not rule out the possibility that they might be tempted to give a bomb to say Hezbollah. And let me just say this, I used to dismiss the possibility that Iran would give a weapon to a non-state actor over which they don't have control. But with, you know, the recent reports that Syria has, you know, is training Hezbollah people on Scud missiles in Syria, preparatory to transferring it to Hezbollah, or maybe they transferred it to Hezbollah and they're staying in Syria. You know, I think we have to change our assessment of it. So I don't rule out the possibility that in the future they might try to, they might give a nuclear weapon to a group such as Hezbollah. But I think their preferred way of going about the destruction of Israel is through arming Hezbollah and Hamas and enabling those groups to conduct a long-term campaign of resistance, whereby the combination of external pressure of, you know, these rocket attacks that we see are continuing in southern Israel today, demographic factors, which I think they read the demography wrong, actually, but that's another issue, eventually lead to the demoralization of Israel. And, you know, you hear people like Efrain Snem, who you were talking about before. Efrain is, you know, a former deputy defense minister, and he's one of the big people in Israel who talk about the acquisition of a nuclear weapon by Iran would create a mass exodus of people in Israel who can emigrate elsewhere, who have other opportunities elsewhere, and would set in motion a long-term process of demoralization and decline in Israel. I think, you know, that's probably the way that most people who are looking, you know, in Iran, who are looking at the destruction of Israel, see it happening. Except, let me just say though, there is, of course, in some of these, and you probably know better than I, because I've done some of the reading of these issues, some of the modest scenarios do involve combat, and a war in what is today Israel. Some of the traditions in the 12 years Islam, and the, you know, the appearance of Qayyim, the Mahdi in Mecca, and then he goes. And there are different traditions. I'm not an expert on this, and this gets into a rather esoteric area. But there are some who do see a war in which the Jews are vanquished, that it, there is a tradition of this in Shiite Islam, and therefore they can see this, you know, part of a war as being part of, kind of fulfilling of the prophecy, if you will, to put it in kind of our own kind of tradition. So I don't dismiss this at all, and I don't. I think this is something. I think it's an outside possibility, but this is a part of the world where outside possibilities, such as people flying airplanes into the World Trade Center, we have to give serious consideration to the possibility that even outside possibilities could happen. So I hope that answers.
I think it does. And there's one dimension I would add to that, which again is the question of this being accomplished by Shiite Persians rather than by Sunni Arabs. I think it would be something that the Iranian leadership, the Victoria, has gained for both the national and the religious agenda.
If I may, I had a question for you. We discussed the United States, we discussed Iran, Israel. In this strategic mindset of Iran that you're talking about, we have also, you mentioned the Southern Arabs, but specifically I'm talking about Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Those are two countries that are, one is getting closer, if you will, in the case of Turkey to Iran, and there seems to be at least a live and let live, if not a détente, or maybe a détente moving towards even a friendship. And Saudis are becoming more and more petrified. They're just not very happy about what's happening, both with Iran as a rising power, whether it's an image or reality, and specifically on Iran's hand in Iraq. That for Saudi Arabia is unacceptable. They can't do much about this. Beyond our own direct involvement, let us say at this point that Israel is content with the status quo, they don't. What do you see of these three countries in the near future? What will the Iranians do, or would any of those countries have a power to do something to alter the reality?
Which would be
Saudi Arabia or Turkey?
You know, I'll be honest with you. In terms of, I don't follow Turkey very closely, so that's, with your permission, I'll punt on that one, and I apologize. Although my sense is, from the limited degree that I do follow it, is that there's actually, there is a certain degree of ambivalence, I think, even among, the ruling party about, they want to have good relations with all their neighbors. That's a fundamental element of the current foreign minister's kind of worldview. But I think there is a potential geopolitical, inevitable, conflict. To the degree that, for instance, we know in Turkey and in Iraq, kind of has taken on the role of a patron of some of the Sunni parties and political groupings, whereas Iran is generally seen as the patron of most of the Shiite groups. So there is potential there for conflict, and also, a nuclear Iran is something which I think will pose, difficult challenges for Turkey in terms of, on the one hand, they see themselves as, increasingly playing a greater regional role, but they're constrained by their, NATO membership and their aspirations for EU membership, from the point of view of developing actual nuclear weapons. So I don't really know how that plays out, and I can't give you a sense in that regard. But clearly, I think, in terms of geopolitics, Turkey and Iran will be much more dynamic actors than Saudi in this regard. I mean, I think Saudi's ability to influence, kind of regional, trends and developments is much more limited, than it was in the past. And we've seen this with Egypt. We've seen the decline of Egypt's role in regional policy. And setting trends and playing a leading role. Saudi's role has diminished in recent years. So I think the dynamic actors, and I'm not original in saying this, are really the non-Arab states now. It's Iran and Turkey, for the most part. So and I think, look, also keep in mind that the pendulum swings back and forth. That we've seen periods in which American influence has waxed and waned. We had, after the Gulf War in 91, we were at the height of our influence, and after a few years, because of sanctions on Iraq, you had sanctions fatigue, anti-Americanism, you had the rise of bin Laden, and then you had again in 2003, you know, for a short period, which, you know, it looked like the United States was on top of its game, and then a period of decline. And we've seen that with Iran as well. So Iran now, because of their role in helping put together the current government in Iraq, I think will be, you know, enjoying a period of heightened prestige. But inevitably, there's always, you know, for every action, there's an opposite reaction. And I think, you know, we have to do what we can to help that along. I don't think we should expect it to happen naturally, but, you know, we should try to encourage it. But I think, you know, Iran's rise we've seen in recent years, which are largely in part due to our own mistakes, not so much, you know, the things that Iran has done right, although they've played it well, but they have critical weaknesses in terms of their economy and how these sanctions are biting, and also the domestic, in terms of their the whole issue of the legitimacy of the regime and the Green Movement, which is not dead yet. So there's a lot of things, you know, the pendulum is swinging, you know, in that direction, but I assume it'll swing back, you know, even if we don't do anything because of, you know, developments in the region. So I know that really didn't answer fully your question, but I just want to also get back to the point about Israel, because one of the problems of Israel's policy of opacity or ambiguity with regards to its nuclear capabilities is that it's not able to speak openly about its capabilities. And that's one area which that might change in the future if Iran does acquire nuclear weapons. But, you know, clearly I think Israel, even if they have contributed to them, which is between 1 and 200, because of the degree to which Iran is an urbanized country, 70% of the population is in urban areas, and probably around, you know, 50% of the population are in the top, you know, 15 cities. They are very vulnerable. You know, everybody says, well, Israel is a, you know, two bomb country, and it's gone, which is probably not quite the case, because we know very often first generation weapons in proliferators often don't function. You know, they often yield suboptimal, you know, yields, which are still potentially devastating. But Israel has the ability to put an end to, you know, God forbid, but to put an end to Iran as we know it. And I think that probably goes through the minds of, you know, of some of the more responsive decision makers there. But I do worry about, you know, people who are, you know, in the grip of a worldview that we don't understand very well, and that is informed by kind of the messianic expectation and the belief that, you know, in the end, that maybe things will go well because the Mahdi is about to return. And we don't quite understand how that might affect decision making. And that goes both ways. It means that it's possible that, you know, as far as our understanding, the Supreme Leader is not captured, does not kind of adhere to this kind of worldview. And this is something which, you know, Ahmadinejad and some people around him adhere to, but it's not necessarily widespread. But if all you need is the right people, you know, or the wrong people, you know, who, to have their finger on the button, you know, to create a, you know, terrible tragedy. So.
Anybody else? Yes, please.
Josh Hines, a commander over at CSIS as a Navy fellow for a year. You talk about the Iranian Navy as part of that strategic deterrent triad that Iran has, and about the past two and a half years, we've seen the Navy sort of expand, regular Navy at least, expand into some more kind of blue water roles, whether it's, you know, the piracy missions in Gulf Aden, or you know, just expanding out of Gulf Oman, getting some visits by Navy leadership to Djibouti and Qatar, and I think this past week Aden talked about asking some GCC counterparts to come and do a multilateral exercise with them. Some things that kind of look like sort of conventional military, almost to use your terms, you know, hard power sort of functions. But going back to your first point about nothing is as it seems, is there a soft power, you know, motivation behind this expansion?
Well, in a way, I mean, it's part of trying to create an image of Iran as a regional power and a rising global power that has, you know, I mean, look, we for, you know, since more than a century now, we set our fleets around the world, you know, kind of to show the flag, and that was part of our soft power, in a way. I would argue actually our calls and kind of visits are using hard power assets to advance the soft power agenda. So I would actually see that as part of their soft power kind of, you know, again, there's no secret there. I mean, we've kind of been doing that, and the Royal Navy did it before us. But so I see it as, you know, I'm not quite sure. So that's another thing that I'm getting my arms around in terms of a growing role in the Indian Ocean. How does this fit into? I mean, on the one hand, I would say it seems to me, in the context of a defensive strategy, set aside, showing the flag, it makes sense that you want to defend the Gulf from as far forward as possible against carrier strike groups or foreign naval threats. So why not push the submarines? I think there was in the publicized recently the Kilos were operating in the Gulf of Oman in that area. Why not get them used to operating in that area so that also from the point of view of deterrence, the enemy knows it's not just once he passes the Strait of Hormuz that he's at risk, but much further out, and therefore raising potential costs in the minds of potential adversaries of tampering with the Iranians. So, I see this as part of both, enabling them to, enhancing their warfighting capabilities, which is hard power, as well as trying to, contribute to the image of Iran as a rising regional and global power by doing stuff that traditional superpowers, do. Play with the big boys, so to speak.
Please join me in thanking my guys.